Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's book review. I hope you're all enjoying the long weekend. And I think we've got a real treat for you here tonight, because this is one of those books that you guys actually asked for. And it is, of course, Norman Finkelstein's The Holocaust Industry. So it's something that I think a lot of people will want to hear about, and a lot of people will enjoy being discussed. And I know I certainly enjoyed reading it, so much so that I've actually been listening to some of his interviews with the mainstream media today. And he's a really interesting person. It's not a particularly long book, so if you've enjoyed the book, I do suggest you go and search out some of those interviews, because they're well worth watching. And hearing him debate with mainstream media personalities and hosts is pretty interesting. And I think it adds something to the book. Anyway, we are live tonight. We're live on Odyssey, we're live on DLive, and we're live on RadioAlbion.com. And if you're enjoying this stream, if you like our work, if you enjoy the book club, and if you value the work Patriotic Alternative does, please feel free to make a contribution to the stream. And you can do so if you just want to donate, or if you want to ask questions or make comments about this particular book or any issues raised tonight. We will deal with those questions and comments in the second half of the show. And you can send these super chats via Entropy or via Odyssey. Both the links are there. If you're watching in Odyssey, you can hit that support button. And if you're watching on DLive or Radio Albion or on Odyssey, if you want to do it through Entropy, you can donate through Entropy as well. And we will read all those questions or comments in the second half of the show. Entropy also allows you to ask unpaid questions if you want to ask those too. You can also donate to me via cryptocurrency. All my crypto links are in the description below. And that's if you're watching on Odyssey or on the replay on DLive, on BitChute, because that's where the replay will be placed as soon as this show is finished. And finally, if you want to contact me about any issues, you can contact me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. So we have our usual panel joining me tonight, and we'll start by going round the panel, and we'll begin with Natty, because he is in the top right-hand corner. How are you doing, Natty? Have you had a good weekend? And what did you think to this book?
Hi, guys. Well, first of all, I apologize because we are 1 week late in reviewing this book, and that is entirely my fault. I spent last weekend at the World Pilot Gig Championships down in the Scilly Isles. Very sunny weekend, got tanned, worked on my guns in the boat. Generally had a good time, but we had to push this book review back 1 week. So apologies for that. Yeah, I really enjoyed the book, and I actually emailed Norman Finkelstein to try and get him on the show, but I only did that yesterday morning, and I haven't heard anything back. And although you might think, well, Norman Finkelstein, a Jewish guy who had one of his parents, or his parents were in the work camps in Nazi Germany in 1945, he wouldn't want anything to do with us, and he wouldn't come on the show. However, for those of you who know his body of work, you'll know he's a pretty fierce critic of a lot of the same things that that we on the dissident right are as well. So it wasn't the long shot that it first appeared. And I think given more time and a bit more pressure, we could have had him on. So it's unfortunate he's not here. It would have been good to talk to him, but there's plenty to discuss in the book anyway. So I think it's going to be good either way.
Okay, and you did enjoy the book, didn't you, Natty?
Yeah, for the most part. I do have my criticisms, and I do think that the scope of the book is somewhat narrow, and the second half of it, if you go into all the appendices and the second half of the book, a lot of it is in reply to a study or something published after the book was released, and it's an appendix. So in a later edition, it was released in reply to this study that came out, or writing that came out on it. So it's kind of like this argument against finding of another Jewish gentleman. So it's kind of autistic towards the back of the book, but generally speaking, he's pretty spot on with what he's saying. However, I think in the last 20 years since it was released, I think we've come to a broader understanding of what the Holocaust is. And it, it isn't simply, it's not just monetary gain and the plundering of the wealth of Switzerland and America and some of the other European countries. But I'm sure we'll get into that. So, yeah.
We certainly will. Now, Aunt Sally, are you with us tonight? Have you sorted your audio issues? We're not getting anything from Aunt Sally. We've had a few. Oh, unmuted.
Yes, hello. Sorry, I was. Can you hear me okay?
We certainly can hear you. How are you doing? Did you have a good weekend and did you enjoy the book?
Yes, sorry. I've missed what you were saying before because of technical difficulties. Yes, I really did enjoy the book. It's quite an eye-opener, to be honest. And yes, I had a good weekend. So I don't know what you've said already, so I don't want to repeat anything. So I'll let you carry on.
No, we've not really said anything. We're just sort of, it's just initial introductions at the moment, checking that everyone's enjoying the bank holiday and the book was to everyone's liking.
Yeah, yeah, it was almost overwhelming in that there's just so much there to take on board. And even though the book itself was only 150 pages, he's added appendices and postscripts and forewords to the first edition, the second edition, and he's added a lot on, but there's just so much there, so much to talk about. I don't know actually where we're going to start, but I'll let you carry on. I've still got things to unpack.
Okay, well, I know where I want to start, but before we do, I'm going to say to Bill Aveling, how are you doing, my friend? Did you have a nice weekend? Are you enjoying the bank holiday? And did you enjoy the book?
Hello, everybody. Good evening. I did have a good weekend. We had a great day yesterday with PA Wales. We were out and about, and it was great to see my friend Joe and all the other guys and girls. And I did enjoy this book. It's not the first time I've read it, and I think you know we'll get into it. But Finkelstein for me raises interesting and relevant questions about the exploitation of events, as laid down in the official narrative. And although it doesn't really, I think there was a reviewer on Mark Webber's Institute for Historical Review who said it doesn't really rehearse any of the traditional historical revisionist arguments. But the focus on the abuse of the Holocaust and the unnatural dominance in American public life really does repeat lots of old revisionist themes as well. But my first reading of it way back when really began my own inquiry into the history and led me to becoming much more critically sceptical about the orthodox historical narrative. So, yeah, it really contributed to my own journey, really. So, yeah, it was a great read, really.
More critically sceptical about.
Okay, thank you so much. Now, I'll weigh in for what it's worth. I like this book for several reasons, not least because it's short. I say this all the time. I like short reads. I like reads that are easy to grasp. And this book's actually available for free in an even shorter version over on archive.org. And that version is the first edition. I actually sent out the second editions to Aunt Sally, Natty and Bill, but you can get it, the first edition, free on archive.org. If you want to get the second edition, which is slightly longer by a further 32 pages, that is available on Amazon for about £7. So this is very, very affordable. It's very digestible and it's very easy. Aunt Sally, you've not muted up. I can hear you. I can hear your keyboard. So it's very digestible. It's very easy to get into. Now, firstly, I think the thing to raise here is obviously Norman Finkelstein is Jewish. Norman Finkelstein is obviously Jewish, and he's talking about something which for him is very interesting to talk about, because he says that both his mother and father were in what he calls concentration camps. And this is quite interesting because I was listening to an interview with him today. And in that interview, the interviewer kept calling them death camps, repeatedly called them death camps. But Norman refused to use that term and steadfastly called them concentration camps, because obviously both his mother and father survived. However, he does go on to say that despite his mother and father surviving, that his the rest of his family, or what would have been his extended family, died in those camps. So it's quite interesting hearing him talk about that, because he doesn't sensationalize any of this. And it seems that his book has two main thrusts. The first thrust is that he is against what he calls the sensationalism around the Holocaust. He's against the fact that people have sensationalized it, that people have added layer upon layer of tawdry, sensational, and very gory detail, which is obviously false. And he's against that. And he's also against, I'd say the second thing that he's against, is using the Holocaust either as a way to deflect or as a tool, really. And the two things he seems to approach most broadly are the fact that it is used to make huge amounts of money, which he sees as almost like a protection racket. He sort of refers to the people doing that basically as gangsters. And the second thing that he seems to object to most heavily is when the Holocaust is used to deflect legitimate criticisms against the state of Israel. So the Holocaust is used almost as a shield. So it's there, and because it's there, you cannot criticize anything that the state of Israel does. And I think that's pretty much a fair overview of the book. It goes into much more detail, but he doesn't delve particularly into what we would say. And this is the interesting thing. I wouldn't class him as a Holocaust denier. He isn't saying it didn't happen. He isn't saying there wasn't suffering. He does approach this in many ways from a Jewish perspective. But I would say, and this is the first sort of point I wanted to discuss, that the establishment would refer to Norman Finkelstein as a Holocaust denier because he basically takes people to task for sensationalizing the Holocaust. So he's against sort of the talk of shrunken heads and masturbation machines and, you know, babies being hurled against electric fences as Nazi guards, you know, chuckle and drink their beer. And in the interview I watched, he actually raised the point that he doesn't believe that all Germans are murderous, terrible beasts, you know, that have this in their blood, because that's another thing that's alleged by many Jews, that sort of Germans or white people as a whole, you know, have these, you know, horrendous feelings that they want to go out and start murdering people. So listening to him and reading the book, I find him a really, really interesting guy. But the first thing I want to ask the panel, starting with you, Natty, obviously the mainstream would call this Holocaust denial. But I felt, and we're going to talk a little bit later about his personal motivations for writing the book, because I find them very interesting, especially after watching his interviews. But would you describe this as Holocaust denial, how would you describe this? Because I think a lot of people would describe it as that in the mainstream, but I certainly wouldn't.
Well, funnily enough, the very last paragraph in the book, in the conclusion, not the postscripts and the appendices, the very last paragraph has a sentence, and I'll read it, and you tell me if anybody in the British political or media establishment said these words or uttered this sentence in sincerity, they'd be accused of Holocaust denial. I'm going to read it now. He said, "The challenge today is to restore the Nazi Holocaust as a rational subject of inquiry. Only then can we really learn from it. The abnormality of the Nazi Holocaust springs not from the event itself, but from the expletive industry that has grown up around it. The Holocaust industry has always been bankrupt. What remains is to openly declare it so." So that's the quote. And again, you've kind of nailed it there, Mark, and you've taken the wind out of my sails, because we're starting at the back of the book with Norman's conclusion here. But again, you tell me, and this is a Jewish guy who, again, we'll talk about his motivations. This is a Jewish guy whose extended family were ostensibly killed in what you call the Nazi Holocaust. Coming out of a sentence like that, where, and this is back in 1998, nobody in the British establishment or the media could say anything even close to that today without being thrown out on their ear and deplatformed and potentially hauled off and questioned for it. So is it Holocaust denial? I'm not sure. I don't think it is. I mean, the term has no meaning. And if it's going to mean anything, it could apply to that today by today's standards. But that, to me, that's not, the book isn't denying anything. He's questioning the motivations of people who have exploited a historical event.
Thank you. Aunt Sally, how would you talk about it in that context? Obviously, Norman Finkelstein, for his entire sort of career, has been dogged with accusations of Holocaust denial, and people would just call this a Holocaust denial text. I certainly wouldn't. How did you feel when you read it? And would you call it Holocaust denial?
No, I wouldn't. I don't. He, from what I can see, he believes his parents, although from what I read, he didn't really discuss it with them. It was one of those things that he said you didn't ask about. He let them, you know, they suffered their pain in their memories, and he didn't question them. So he didn't really get any account from his parents. As far as what was the question again? Sorry, I'm scatty tonight.
No, I was just saying that he's been repeatedly attacked throughout his career with the usual slurs of Holocaust denial, Holocaust denial. And when I read the book, I see people as Holocaust denials. People say, it never happened. Nothing ever happened. Nothing took place there. You know, no Jews died, etc. And I think he's not really a denier of anything. He's just a man who wants to know sort of what the real truth was and to put things in a genuine perspective and understand why they took place. And I find it interesting that even as a Jew, he's been so maligned by, you know, obviously what he terms as the Holocaust industry. And I was just asking you your sort of opinion on whether you felt it was a Holocaust denial text.
No, definitely not. Definitely not. From what I can see, he totally believes that people were gassed and, all the rest of it. The other point he says as well is that the gypsies, he thinks, or somewhere in the text, that there was just as many gypsies as Jews murdered at Auschwitz, and they should be compensated. So no, he's fully on. He fully believes the Holocaust, and I just wonder what he would say now, all these years later, that more and more evidence is coming out, more and more people are questioning it. I wonder what his stance would be now. You said you watched an interview. When was the interview?
It was years ago. I could actually dig it out and share it on my social media because it's really, really interesting. And when you actually hear him speak, this is a bit of a diversion, but some people would probably find it quite difficult to listen to him because he's actually very robotic. He doesn't move very much when he's talking. He's not very expressive. But everything he says is so carefully measured. Almost as if he was a living computer. And I know that's not meant to sound insulting or demeaning, but that's how he comes across. He seems to come across almost like a living computer, like he's there just processing data and spitting it out at the interviewer in this very dispassionate but honest and factual way.
That makes me think he's probably autistic. So I did actually briefly look up a bit about him on Wikipedia, and He did suffer for asking the wrong questions. From what I could see, he lost his tenure at the university. They got rid of him. He lost his career for writing this book. So no, he suffered. He suffered, but not in the way that everyone else would be locked up. Mind you, that was 20 years ago. He probably would be locked up now. I don't know.
Well, let me break in here a second, right? Because there's another quote in the chapter Hoaxers, Hucksters, and History. He's talking about Deborah Lipstadt, who we may get to later, who's one of the great fraudsters of the Holocaust funds and someone who's constantly denouncing people. And Norman says this, okay, so this might give us a clue as to his mindset about what denial is or isn't, or whether it's valid or not. He said, to question a survivor's testimony, to denounce the role of Jewish collaborators, to suggest that Germans suffered during the bombing of Dresden, or that any state except Germany committed crimes in World War II, this is all evidence, according to Lipstadt, of Holocaust denial. So he knows what he's getting up to. I mean, because all of those things can be done. But Deborah Lipstadt, who has a very big influence on the Zog government of America, is in her eyes, that all everything there is just tantamount to Holocaust denial. I mean, who are we supposed to ignore that German suffered, or that Dresden was a atrocity, or that eyewitness testimonies is sometimes bunk? I mean, of course it is, and yet these things are all just included in thrown in as Holocaust denial, according to Deborah Lipstadt and some of the others who are involved in taking money off Switzerland and Europe and various other people to line their own pockets, as well as some other cultural reasons that we might get into.
One of the things for me reading this book is I read it mostly with my mouth open. It's like, they did what? And then you turn another page and it's like, what? What? I mean, it's outrageous what they did. And then with his appendices, they did it. Even when you think they can't do any more, they did more. They literally put everybody on their asses, every nation, every country in the Swiss. What they did, I didn't know about any of that until this book. What they did to the Swiss to extort money from them is just the chutzpah. Even he said that somewhere, the chutzpah of them, you know, and none of the money. Well, we haven't even got round to where the money really went, because it didn't really go to the survivors, did it?
No, not at all. And when it did, it was a pittance, which is, you know, it just goes to show.
When I watched the interview, with him, and he threw out a figure, which I should imagine is much bigger today, or much bigger, you know, because obviously, you know, they're still doing this. But the figure he threw out during the interview was that 14 billion had been taken in total by these Jewish sort of funds and these Jewish groups, and they'd taken 14 billion in total, and they weren't even provide his one of his big contentions was that none of that goes to Jewish families who apparently suffered. So he was saying they won't even cover, they've taken 14 billion and they won't even cover basic medical expenses or medical insurance for so-called survivors who are now pensioners. And when you're listening to him talking like that, it's very, very interesting, because he's basically saying just flat out that this is a complete protection scam. This is, a mafia scam where if you don't pay up, basically that's it. If you're not paying up, you're losing everything. And it's so interesting to hear him talk like that.
Yeah, they tried it on with France as well. And luckily, it was at the end of Clinton's reign, and they knew they didn't have steam to go after France, although I think they have got money from France. But the people who were doing this have all that money is sitting around somewhere and still exists. And throughout the book, you've said 14 billion. The amount of almost, I'd say, autistic detail that Norman Finkelstein goes into about who gave what, and most of it is coming from Switzerland, or the stuff he covers here, for the most part, is coming from Swiss banks. The amount of detail he goes into, it's not hard to imagine that he's got that figure somewhere pretty much bang on. 14 billion is no small sum of money, especially considering that they were fudging numbers all over the place. They would, and at the same time, denying claims from people who were saying they were Holocaust survivors, and they were relatives of Holocaust survivors whose possessions got taken and all the rest of it. Yet the people in charge, and we may get round to some of the names here, the people in charge were denying those claims and keeping the money. So on the one hand, they could say, we've got, you know, a list of 500,000 survivors who we want money for. But on the other hand, when those survivors come to them and say, okay, let's have the money, these organizations are saying, no, you don't reach the evidentiary standard. We're going to keep this money for more needy, you know, more needy Holocaust survivors. It really is disgusting on its face.
That was, you know, I just echo what Sally said there in terms of being absolutely shocked by it. And certainly when I first read it, and that's going back about 15 or 20 years ago, that was the one thing that it really struck me. I mean, I think Switzerland itself, it was had something like 1.25 billion extorted from it. And they were threatened with economic sanctions. So it was done in a kind of a governmental way to extort this money from them. But what, just going back to what Sally was saying about being autistic, and I think I had that same thought. I think he just sees injustice in what's happened and has to say it. And he writes, I mean, he's an academic, and he writes as an academic should write, unlike, say, Daniel Goldhagen, who wrote the bizarre and absurd book Hitler's Willing Executioners, and Finkelstein really satisfyingly eviscerates that book in his book. You know, unlike Goldhagen, Finkelstein provides evidence, logical arguments, and draws appropriate conclusions throughout. And as a result, his detractors are just left to decry his work with ad hominem attacks and declare him a self-hating Jew. And when they reach that kind of level, well, you know that the person that they're attacking is probably doing something right. Yeah, I thought it was, there's aspects of it which, as Natty said, I find problematic a little bit, because he does stick very much to the very orthodox interpretation. And there are elements that are skirted over too lightly, or perhaps not engaged with, beyond the kind of hyperinflation of the Holocaust after 1967, which was done, of course, we'll probably get into that, for political, financial reasons after the Arab-Israeli war. Finkelstein doesn't engage with any questions of the creation of the narrative. He accepts the orthodox history as an historical event. There are no mention of the controversies cited by revisionists over the reconstruction of gas chambers in Auschwitz, for example. I think another Jewish scholar, David Cole, who's also been regarded as a self-hating Jew, he, in his very famous interview with Dr. Pieper, and he was the Auschwitz State Museum senior curator, got him to admit that the gas chamber that is currently visited by millions of people at the camp was built after the war. He dismisses Arthur Butz, the revisionist author of The Hoax of the 20th Century, as being insignificant. And he does offer some guarded praise for David Irving, which is quite interesting as well. But yeah, it's one of those books where I think if you read it for the first time, and especially if you're perhaps not au fait with the whole story or the history generally, it leaves you with your mouth hanging open, certainly.
So I think we're all in agreement. This isn't some sort of, this book wasn't written to bait anyone. This book was written not from a point of view of saying this event didn't exist, but to talk about the implications of the way this has been sold, and to also discuss to a certain degree how he feels, and I do believe it's him, how he feels that the current Holocaust narrative, or the sort of post-1970s Holocaust narrative, has been used in a very disingenuous way. Now, should we talk about his motivation for writing this? Because obviously people are going to look at this and say, well, you've got a Jewish fella here, and he's basically launching an attack on Jewish organizations for their portrayal of the Holocaust. And people are going to say, well, what is his motivation? Now, when I read the book, I was actually quite interested in this, but I felt he covered this very well, again, in the interview that I watched, because he claimed that his motivation was that he feels that not only is the Holocaust being used in a grossly unfair way to basically extort money from governments for a small group of people to enrich themselves, and not only is the Holocaust being used to silence legitimate debate around the state of Israel and some of the actions that the state of Israel commits itself to, but he seems to want to come at this from the point of view that he, or he claims, he feels it's disrespectful to genuine victims and that it does tarnish the memory and experiences of Jews who did suffer by sensationalizing this. Now, I think that's a really, really interesting way to come at this, because it seems that other Jews who have spoken about the Holocaust, and most people who talk about the Holocaust, simply claim to be on a journey of truth. They are truth seekers who want to get to the bottom of something and want to know exactly why something is being done. But Norman Finkelstein seems to actually have motivation. And I sort of picked up that much of this is to actually, in his mind, or as he puts it over, to sort of honour his parents' story. So do you want to talk a little bit of his motivation? And then let's talk about the two main thrusts, the financial aspect and the protection of Israel. And potentially, as Natty pointed out, the third more modern thrust, which is, of course, white guilt. So what do you think his motivations were, Natty? And then we'll go around the group asking the same question to everyone.
I'm mainly on board with what you've just said. I haven't seen any of the interviews, but one of the quite often in the book club, you read through the pages or something will kind of speak to you through what's written down, and you get a force of what the writer's going for, and they're kind of, you can feel their what's coming through emotionally in some cases. And there is a genuine sense that he is angry about the fact that the hucksters and the fraudsters who have taken money are actually taking legitimate reparations, what he feels are legitimate reparations from actual survivors who've been through some sort of horrible experience and who are owed money. And I think that's kind of apparent in his familial ties. Obviously he's going to feel that. He also clearly, I think, is motivated by the fact that the Jews acting like they are, or the Jews who are capitalizing on the Holocaust for either monetary gain or cultural reasons, in order to guilt white Europeans and take power in terms of what we are and aren't allowed to talk about politically, is more that he's worried about a backlash against Jews, I think. And I'm just going to read a passage from page 253, and this is the second appendix to the paperback edition. So I'm not sure this would have been in the short 150-page book, but I'm going to read this now, all right? So Norman Finkelstein says, "It's unclear, however, how inflating the number of Holocaust survivors, thereby deflating the number of Holocaust deaths, or how Jewish leaders carrying on like caricatures straight from the pages of Der Stürmer and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion helped marginalize Holocaust deniers. The Holocaust industry has designated as a main beneficiary of compensation monies Holocaust education, which according to Eisenstadt constitutes the greatest legacy of our efforts." In other words, what he's saying is the fraudsters who gathered all this money and put so much pressure on Switzerland and other places to hand over money have been acting in exactly the same way that the National Socialists were portraying them in their propaganda, you know, 5 years after all of this bad stuff happened and that led up to all of this bad stuff happening to them. And that by having this front and center in Eisenstadt's words, the main legacy, this is their main effort, is this great reparations of money that is gained fraudulently, is doing massive damage and is encouraging exactly the type of talk and the kind of J-pilling we've seen over the last 5 or 10 years. And remember that this is now a 20-year-old book, so it would have been interesting to hear what Norman Finkelstein would have said, given today's climate where, although dissidents are pushed to the fringes, we are actually metastasizing around a pretty solid idea of Jewish power and Jewish overrepresentation. It would be interesting to see what he would have said about that, because in some ways, his conclusion there actually has some prescience and is coming to pass.
Yeah, you know what he does mention about anti-Semitism coming as a result of the particularly the Swiss banking debacle. When they went after the Swiss banks, he said that the Jews were hated in Switzerland, but also I think there was land grabs, property grabs in Poland, and he said the Poles again, they were turning on the Jews. So anti-Semitism was coming as a result of the Holocaust industry rather than genuine dislike of Jews. So yeah, he said that. For me, I'm sure you're just about to ask me, Mark, the same question. I found Finkelstein to be, maybe I'm being a bit naive, but I found him to be a moral humanitarian, that he really genuinely cared about right and wrong, and the fact that so many other people were wronged who they don't mention, like the gypsies and the handicapped and everyone else he thinks were offed by the Nazis. He also, in the book, talks a lot about reparations for slavery, African-American slavery. That's mentioned quite a few times. And also, I think in the appendices somewhere, about some outrageous amount of money that didn't go to the Indigenous American Indians. So he does seem to care about right and wrong. That's my feminine opinion anyway, and I think that's where he was coming from.
I had both of those marked in my notes, Sally, and to my mind, that marked him out as something of a lefty. I mean, reparations, I've got it down here in my notes, so we may come to this at the end, but the whole issue about the Indian Americans and the blacks demanding reparations is somewhere that I do think he's kind of exposed himself as a 1960s social reformist from America who was more than willing to team up. And in fact, there are some quotes in here. He was more than willing to accept that Jews would team up with blacks. He doesn't mention against who, although it's quite obvious reading between the lines. So this is where I think, for me, Norman Finkelstein loses his appeal somewhat.
Yeah, me too. I actually wrote lefty. I wrote that
He is. I think he's honest. I think he's. I mean, if there can be such a thing, I think he's an honest lefty, to be honest. But I also think he's, you know, righteously indignant about the exploitation. But we, you know, coming back to that idea of him being a liberal or a lefty, he is to some degree an acolyte of Noam Chomsky. And he comes from that intellectual tradition that has really placed him at loggerheads with the academic establishment in America. So he's very much of that school. You know, and I think this is a critical thing. You know, he begins by explaining how historically the Holocaust didn't figure at all in the narrative history of World War II. You know, just to quote him, he said, "Not only Americans in general, but also American Jews, including Jewish intellectuals, paid the Nazi Holocaust little heed." And then when someone begins a text with this, another quote, he says, "The Holocaust has proven to be an indispensable ideological weapon, and that," again, he says, "the most successful ethnic group in the United States has likewise acquired victim status." You know, you're onto something interesting. Critically, he states that everything changed after the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, when the Holocaust became a significant event in the mainstream narrative. Now, when I first read it, that was to me a kind of a bombshell, because I hadn't really looked into that kind of, you know, that history. When I was young, and the Holocaust was starting to become a thing in the sort of late 70s, but you know, much more so, and of course that's accelerated since. But and as again, as he says, once ideologically recast, the Holocaust proved to be the perfect weapon for deflecting criticism of Israel, and later adds, "Invoking the Holocaust was therefore a ploy to delegitimize all criticism of Jews. Such criticism could only spring from pathological hatred." And then he concludes there with, "All the world wants the Jews dead. then truly the wonder is that they are still alive and are, like much of humanity, not exactly starving. So there's immediately a huge amount there to condemn him. And that condemnation came, of course, but he's writing from a refusenik kind of position in a Chomskyan way, I guess. That's where he's coming from. It's that kind of intellectual tradition, which is critical of Israeli power and critical of... So there's a kind of an honesty to it. Much of it I don't agree with, and some of it I would say, well, you know, that there's common ground there as well.
Okay, well, let's get into the meat of his arguments now. Now, I think the first is clearly the fact that he feels, and he makes a very, very... Look, I'm not disagreeing with the guy. When I say he feels, I'm not disagreeing with him. And I think it would be very hard to... It'd be very hard for anyone to disagree with him who read this text. Now, some people will obviously say that we're biased because we are all ethno-nationalists. We talk about Jewish power. But I think Norman Finkelstein makes an excellent argument here. He frames his argument correctly. And there's a huge amount of footnotes and appendices to prove what he's saying. And I think the first thrust of his argument is that there's this sensationalism around the Holocaust because it is, in large part, a financial scam. It is a way to gain billions in reparations for crimes that, in many cases, did not occur, that are now woven so deeply. And he talks about this as well throughout the book, how the Holocaust has become woven so deeply into the American psyche that it's become this unquestionable truth, that it's everywhere, that you're always surrounded by information about the Holocaust. And it's so salacious, it's so overpowering, that it becomes part of everyone's thinking, to the point where you say that word and you have this, well, normal people have this visceral reaction. And his first, and you can talk about that as well when we go around the group, how he, you know, talks about how this has become ingrained in the American psyche. But I think the first point is that he really, really does emphasize and prove that this is almost like a mafia racket, that this is a way to extort billions and billions of dollars out of different countries, which then filters down into Jewish hands. And as he puts it, doesn't even go to quote unquote genuine victims. We'll start with you, Natty. Let's talk about the finances here.
So I'm actually of the opinion that the finances were important to begin with. Sorry. So what Norman says is the 67 war, the Israeli war, and the creation of Israel, before that point, the Jews in the American government weren't too keen to poke their heads above the parapet and start shilling for Israel and being very vocal about Israel, because they weren't too sure how the American people would react. Now, these I can't remember the names of them now, or their acronyms, but these Holocaust fund grabbers come on the scene, use the 1967 war to start putting pressure on Swiss banks and garnering support from the American government. And they find that it's going to be immensely profitable. They can use guilt against the Swiss banks, which, you know, guilt is a major theme in this, is, you know, now 50 years on from this, guilt being a major theme of all this, and starts taking money from Switzerland and seeing that they can actually just grab and grab and grab, and they're not going to have to give too much of it away. As I alluded to earlier, a lot of the Holocaust claimants were denied by these organizations. But it's actually, and whether they knew this was going to happen or they knew this was on the cards, the motivations have changed. I think they realized that the sanctions that the US government could put on Switzerland, whatever they were, mostly economic sanctions, but they, you know, the US obviously put sanctions on countries all over the world for various reasons. The sanctions that the US government could bring to bear, combined with the guilt that Zog Media could put on countries, and in this case, the Swiss banks, could very, very easily and appropriately be turned to internal politics, and the money became secondary. Now, Finkelstein doesn't really talk about this in the book. This is me giving my conclusion 20 years after this book was written, given where we are now. And it's maybe a bit trite of me to say, well, now I'm JQ-pilled, now I'm red-pilled, I can understand this, given that my understanding of history is only 5 years old. But that's how I read it. And this exploitation and this money grab was quite important to begin with and still remains very important. But the lessons that have come out of it about guilt and the application of power and media have been much more valuable to them.
Okay, same question to you, Sally. What did you think about the way he talks about the finances? Because obviously we're talking about vast, vast sums of money. And he's obviously broaching a subject here that I think many Jews would feel very uncomfortable about. And you can see that when he is interviewed, the interviewers feel very uncomfortable about it. But nonetheless, it is a very important point. And I think he proves his point throughout the book without a shadow of a doubt.
I agree with what Natty said. And this is why he, Finkelstein, calls it an industry, because it was an industry of not just about money grabbing, which the money that they grabbed didn't really go to any genuine survivors. It went to foundations and big Jewish organisations to further things in Israel. But also the fact that the American congressmen, politicians were all on their side. So they were unbeatable, really, that the industry was unstoppable. They had the legal power behind these three legal teams. I think they would just show up somewhere and everyone would acquiesce because of the power behind. No one could fight it, from what I could see. Again, that caused the real anti-Semitism. But the Jews at the bottom didn't get subtle. What Natty said as well about it's not just money, it's the power. It's hard to explain it. I'll let you move on.
Well, yeah, I think, Natty mentioned some of the different acronyms, like the World Jewish Restitution Organization, for example, or one. And people were, the Swiss at first were sort of trying to bend over backwards and say, okay, well, we've got to get out of this situation, but they're turning the screw. For example, Switzerland in 1997 said they would establish a $200 million fund, a special fund for needy victims of the Holocaust. But that wasn't enough, and they kept on turning the screw. And then you had, a New York group headed by a guy called D'Amato, saying things like, I want $3 billion or northward. In order to end it all, the class action suits, the Volcker process and the rest. I mean, they were really putting that, and they were talking about, it's coming to a point where it has to resolve itself, where it has to be total war. It's incredible. It's an incredible story. And that's just Switzerland. That's just one country that was affected in this manner. And that was forced, as I said earlier, to cough up, which was eventually about $1.25 billion. And then, of course, when they settled with Switzerland, they turned to Germany, they turned their attentions on Germany. So it just sort of continued. I think it's just incredible, how that continued and just steamrolled onwards. They were talking about economic sanctions. Government was involved. It was a really kind of a matter of international intrigue. And the Swiss just had to fold in the end.
Well, I don't want to, I've said a lot about the political aspects of it. So I don't want to sell it short. Money is obviously a massive motivating factor. And these organizations did get a lot of money. I mean, if you think there are individuals involved here, and the sums we're talking about are staggering, eye-wateringly high, billions and billions of pounds, millions of pounds. And the kind of effect that would have on a lawyer who is getting involved, or some, you know, if you were floating around the edges of this and you heard sums like that being bandied around, you would be like a shark in the water. You know, you'd think, well, I'll come in, I'll take a piece of this, I'll get involved here. And you can imagine that the leaders and the CEOs of these organizations realized, on the one hand, that they could get some money, and that was a motivator, but they realized what a powerful weapon they had to get that money. And I'm sure that even today, reclamation of funds, I know it's going on in Poland, for instance, today, I'm sure in other places as well, but realizing what a powerful tool in their belt they had with, you know, an almost totally open Jewish American government, and the stick of guilt just to beat everyone over the head. And I know that's faltered somewhat recently with the Ukraine war and the kind of fracturing of American hegemon, but must have been an absolutely tremendous motivator. And I think the two go hand in hand. So it's not to denigrate the fact that Norman's saying he knows how important the money is to these people, and how much they've been rubbing their hands and in glee about getting it. But it's just, in my opinion, there's like a thin layer on top of that that's even more useful to these people.
I was looking at my notes just while we're on the subject of the money, and I've got something here about Poland, that the Holocaust industry attorneys filed a class action lawsuit for all the Jewish assets of Holocaust survivors. So they went back to Poland, where places have been rebuilt and what have you, and just this piece of land belonged to a Holocaust survivor, and 100% the property and assets seized during the Holocaust, they wanted all of it. So your house is built on land that belonged to a Holocaust survivor, we want that land, and you know, that kind of thing.
As long as I can remember, even before I was red-pilled, as long as I can remember, I've constantly heard demands that Poland owes money, Poland owes fealty, Poland's got to bend the knee. That it's like a staple of like modern politics. You know, you can open the newspaper on any random week and you'll find some Israel demands more land off Poland, or the ADL is demanding that any trip to Auschwitz has to include this statement from the tour guides, or, you know, whatever it is. It's just Poland has to keep giving and giving and giving, and Poland's so guilty. I think it's because they know there's a lingering national anti-Semitism there, whereas in Germany they've got it totally under the thumb, they've got it totally wrapped up. Poland not so much, maybe.
I mean, he also says that local Jewish communities in various places in Eastern Europe, the communities staked out claims on heirless Jewish assets. So, you know, the community within could say, right, okay, well, that over there, that was Mr. Fink, I'm trying to think of a Jewish name, Mr. Somebody Berg's house. That was, you know, so
look in the comment section on the Odyssey chat. I'm sure they'll help you out, Sally.
All right, yeah, just I went blank there, but he also says that there was some proposition on page 138 to give some of the dollars to the Palestinians, like, you know, to compensate them for the land that they lost when Israel became a country. And nothing really happened, just all fell on dead ear, they didn't get anything. So, that was a proposition put forward that disappeared, funnily enough.
Well, one of the running themes through the book, and obviously Norman Finkelstein is quite a proponent of the Palestinian cause, and I know this speaking to one of my family members who's quite involved in Palestine Action, is that you guys would know this, and I'm sure everyone listening knows this, any time, I think Ken Livingstone ran afoul of this as well, where you compare Israel and Palestine to, you know, Nazi Germany and the Jews, is like one of the worst anti-Semitisms you can do, because to compare it is so terrible, and you can't do it and you can't mention it. And there's a lot of examples in this book of Norman Finkelstein, you know, taking extreme umbrage with this. Towards the end of the first chapter, he says, "Just as Israelis, armed to the teeth by the United States, courageously put unruly Palestinians in their place, so American Jews courageously put unruly blacks in their place." He's talking about the end of civil rights, the end of the Jewish and black union and civil rights in a specific case. But he totally understands that the way Israel treats Palestine is, in his mind, just analogous to the way that Jews were treated in Europe.
It's really interesting that you say that, because in some ways this book is quite prophetic, or maybe not prophetic, but it points towards the future. I'm just going to Google this so you can actually hear me typing here, unfortunately. If you look at the international definition of anti-Semitism, and this is what everyone signs up to, the international definition of anti-Semitism, it is, it includes, and I can't blooming find it now. Ah, here it is. You are anti-Semitic if you accuse the Jews as a people, or Israel as a state, of inventing or exaggerating the Holocaust, accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide than to the interests of their own nation. I mean, that's absurd. So that'd be like saying, like, when Chinese diplomats come and live in Britain, or when Russians come and live in Britain, there's always this media sort of spin that they will obviously, and they will obviously, be more loyal to their own country than they will be to the country they're living in. But you can't say that about Jews. But another thing in this international definition of anti-Semitism is using the symbols and images associated with classic anti-Semitism to characterize Israel or Israelis, drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis, and holding Jews collectively responsible for the actions of the state of Israel. And then it goes on to say anti-Semitic acts are criminal. So basically, they're saying that you're a criminal if you liken Israeli policy towards Palestinians to Nazi policy towards Jews. And this is something that at the time was the reason why, I forget his name now, Jeremy Corbyn was initially against signing up to this international definition of anti-Semitism, because he did not want to bow to this, because he's a true dyed-in-the-wool lefty who wants to criticize Israel and believes that Israel is an oppressive state that oppresses the Palestinian people and essentially brutalizes them. But you cannot say that anymore. That is something that is now off limits. You can't talk about that, because if you do talk about that, you're going to be in deep, deep trouble. And you're in deep, deep trouble because you are breaching the international definition of anti-Semitism. And I think Finkelstein sort of points towards, obviously he didn't know this was going to be drafted, but he does point towards this.
Well, all it means is that every single person who tells the truth about any subject concerning Jewish people is just an anti-Semite under that definition. And in some ways I do have, I'm not against the idea that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic. I mean, I'm fine with that. Apart from the fact that anti-Semitism is enough to get you canceled and deplatformed and all the rest of it, and sometimes worse, the fact that it's a state created for Jewish people, well, if you're creating the body of Jewish people, then fair enough. If you want to call it anti-Semitism, then fair enough. But in, you have to throw in with that almost anyone who has their deepest thoughts and opinions about Jewish overrepresentation and Jewish power gets lumped in with it. you know, and including, I'm afraid, Norman Finkelstein. So, you know, Bobby Fischer and Norman Finkelstein, eat your heart out. You're now by the signed up national anti-Semitism definition, you're now anti-Semites.
Indeed. I think that really segues on to the next part of this, which is equally as important, if not more so, than the money. And Finkelstein, and I'm not really going to introduce this part, I'm going to throw it over to you three straight away, but Finkelstein comes out swinging, saying that this isn't just all about money. And I would argue the Holocaust is really about multiple things. And there's another thing that we're going to talk about that Finkelstein doesn't talk about. But he does talk about the state of Israel and how the Holocaust is used to shield the state of Israel from any criticism or from any political or international repercussions for its actions. And I think he was talking about this quite some time ago. I don't actually have the date when the book was written in front of me, unfortunately. But he's talking about this quite some time ago. And he couldn't really be more on the money, could he? This couldn't be more, this couldn't be more on point today, because it's absolutely used in the same way today. It's used in exactly that way to silence any criticism of the state of Israel. And it's kind of bled in to that definition of anti-Semitism. So what do you think to this, Natty? And what do you think of this as a thread in the book?
Well, to bring it down a notch or two, it goes to serve that popular meme. Oy vey, it's another Shoah. And the reason that meme has bearance is because it's like every slightest insult or voice raised against Jews is tantamount to another Holocaust. It's another Shoah. Oh no, you've called out the vast overrepresentation of Jews in media. It's another Shoah. Interestingly, Finkelstein at the start of the second chapter, Hoaxes, Hucksters and History, he says this, and this is from the Israeli writer Boaz Evron. In and of itself, the Nazi Holocaust does not serve any particular political agenda. Well, first of all, if you're talking about left versus right politics, you may be able to claim that. I don't think that's true. It can just as easily motivate dissent from as support for Israeli policy. Now, I think he's criticizing Boaz Evron, the Israeli writer there, because Boaz Evron's saying, no, the Holocaust has no bearing on what you think about Israel. You know, people who support Israel can use it and people who dissent from Israel can use it, which is obviously totally false. It serves a massive political advantage if you've got every Western nation funding you and all of their people cowering in terror because of this historical event that they can't talk about for fear if they do, they're now treading the line towards becoming the next, you know, Fourth Reich and gassing these people to death just by criticizing this country. It's like a brain shortcut, political shortcut. If you say this, if you say immigrants are invading Dover, well, guess what? Six steps down the road, you're going to be goose-stepping and throwing Jews into ovens. It's lazy politics, but it has purchase in today's world, unfortunately. So it's massively, massively political expedient to have the Holocaust as your kind of national religion.
So Aunt Sally and Bill, take it away. What do you think about this idea? And I think he puts this perfectly, that the Holocaust, with it being woven so deeply into our society, acts as a shield. And I want to throw this out, actually, Natty. I didn't ask you this, and I've got this down in my notes. He mainly talks about the Holocaust being a shield for the state of Israel. But I would go further. I would say the Holocaust is a shield, really, for Jews in general. I think, yes, it does serve the state of Israel. But I think it would be very naive for anyone just to say, yeah, that's all it serves. I believe it serves, you know, not only the state of Israel, but Jews in general use this as a way to deflect criticism from their actions, whether it's on behalf of the state of Israel or indeed any other action particularly. But yeah, Natty, Aunt Sally and Bill.
To be fair to Norman Finkelstein, he is writing this in the narrow scope of the 67 Israel war and the can't remember what year it was, the 50s Israel war. So I think what he's saying is that it was a shield for, narrowly speaking, the Jewish American politicians who then felt it acceptable to poke their heads up above into the open and advocate for Israel openly, as opposed to doing it in back rooms and such. But you're absolutely right. It's become something else. And I hope that, given his honesty everywhere else, I hope that Norman Finkelstein would recognize that.
Just going from my notes, I've got page 48, the uniqueness of the Holocaust is moral capital, serves Israel's prize alibi, adds to moral and emotional claims Israel can make on other nations, gives Jews the right to consider themselves specially threatened and worthy of efforts necessary for survival. By conferring blamelessness on Jews, the Holocaust dogma immunizes Israel and American Jewry from any censure, from legitimate censure. That's just some of my notes. I've got loads more on it. By the 1970s, he notes that anti-Semitism didn't really exist anymore. It wasn't a thing. Yet Jewish leaders started sounding alarm bells that American Jewry was threatened by virulent new anti-Semitism. That was in the 70s. And that was when I think the industry itself sort of stepped up and started, how it played a critical role to deflect present day criticism. And he says somewhere else, lording it over those least able to defend themselves, that is the real context of organised American Jewry, reclaimed courage. So, yeah, those were things that they're just notes I've made that stood out to me about.
It's funny, just breaking in, Sal, that last quote, Norman Finkelstein was probably talking about those least able to defend themselves. Finkelstein then was probably talking about American blacks, maybe Native Americans, gays, things like that. And yet today, that would be whites, European whites.
Yeah.
And, you know, this idea, I mean, we've talked about this now, but the Holocaust became effectively the kind of golden calf of delegitimizing criticism of Israel and Jews. And yet at the same time as being a shield, it became a sword in a way that we are not allowed to use in other contexts, but when it's presented from a pro-Israeli or a Jewish point of view, it is allowed to be a sword. So for example, when the US bombed Serbia, our friend Daniel Goldhagen, the spurious academic who wrote Hitler's Willing Executioners, compares Serbian crimes against Kosovo with the Final Solution. So then it's okay to use that analogy. And then you've got President Clinton sending Elie Wiesel to Kosovo refugee camps in Macedonia and Albania to shed tears, as Finkelstein says, on cue for the Kosovars. So it works both ways in the right context, but it doesn't work for anybody else. You can't use it as a comparative element for any other kind of conflict. So it's grown into a monstrous kind of cudgel to beat anybody down with, if they dare to sort of make any kind of criticisms of either Israel or even the kind of power play of the Jewish lobby in the United States.
It's quite funny, actually, you say that, Bill, because it's very recently the debate, the UK political debate, red versus blue Finkel fight, was allowed to broach this, where I cannot remember who said it, but they were saying that, oh, this talk of an invasion on the coast down at Dover is reminiscent of Nazism, and you have this 3 or 4 day news cycle of people saying this isn't acceptable, and then they say, oh no, it is acceptable, this is exactly like, you know, Nazi Germany and all the rest of it. And all it does is reinforce the idea that, like, nationalism is bad. So both sides, it's totally on board with it. But the idea in the first place is, like, somebody, I cannot remember who it was now, has given permission for this this comparison to be made. Like you're alluding to, Bill, where he sends Elie Wiesel into Kosovo to shed tears. And then it's okay to say it's, you know, like the Holocaust again, or like Nazi Germany again. We have to be given permission in our own political media circus to use it as a comparison. It really is like a power play.
It certainly is. Now I want to move on to something that I found maybe was left out of the book, but I've talked about the Holocaust quite a bit, and if you haven't heard, I've written a book called The Fall of Western Man. It's available for free from my website, which is www.thefallofwesternman.com. And in my book, I talk about white guilt, and I say there are three central pillars of white guilt, which are slavery, colonialization, and the Holocaust. Now, Finkelstein doesn't seem to talk about white guilt. He doesn't seem to get on to this third strand of what I would say the Holocaust is about. So on one hand, I would definitely say it's a way that Jews make huge, huge sums of money. That's undeniable. On the next strand, it's about reducing criticism of Jews or of Israel. That, again, is undoubtable. But finally, I don't think it's really too much of a stretch to say that it is used as a central pillar of white guilt, to make white people hate themselves, to make white people scorn nationalism, to make white people look at their people and say, look, if we have in-group preference, and I've actually, you know, we've seen Jews say this, you know, when white people have in-group preference, that's a bad thing because Holocaust. And that is something that is regularly used. That is an attack that's regularly used against nationalism. Now, I've obviously been in nationalism now for, since the year 2000, so 23 years, and I've seen enough election campaigns and I've seen enough anti-nationalist leaflets put out at elections that, you know, have pictures of Auschwitz on them, that have pictures of piles of bodies. And they've literally said on those leaflets, if you vote for this nationalist party, you're taking a step towards this happening again. And they use the phrase, which I'm sure everyone who's watching tonight, everyone in this panel has heard, never again. That's one of their, you know, sort of powerful phrases. And they've used that against nationalist parties in this country who are, you know, campaigning very legitimately for the rights of indigenous people and to limit mass immigration, which is obviously something that Jews do quite readily over in the state of Israel, over in their, you know, ethno-state, their homeland. Now, Finkelstein doesn't approach this, and I think this will, obviously we'll do criticisms of Finkelstein soon, but I think this might overlap with this. I think this is because Finkelstein, despite going after Jews, so to speak, or going after the Holocaust and the people who peddle the Holocaust industry, he isn't somebody that I would say is necessarily an ally of nationalism. He's not somebody that you would say, well, look, this guy is on our side, or this guy is bringing things to the table that in order to help us. Now, obviously, people can be a curious ally, whether they're trying to help you or not. But I would sort of wager that this isn't anything to do with helping nationalism. This is to do with something completely different. And I don't really think in any of his critiques he particularly has white people as one of his interests or one of the groups that he cares about. I don't think he's doing this for the good of people of European descent. And that's why I talk so heavily about his motivation earlier, because you might say that anyone who is, you know, basically blowing apart some of this Holocaust mythology or trying to break the power of the Holocaust is doing us a great favor. And I think in some ways he certainly is. Well, in many ways he is. But I don't think he's doing it for our benefit is what I'm saying. And but some people might argue that in a different way. People might say, well, when he wrote this book, anti-whitism, as we know it, the anti-white rhetoric, ideas of white privilege, etc., they weren't something that were, you know, at all known about. You know, back in the 1970s and 1980s, you know, when I was born, when I was being educated in the 1990s, I never heard of white privilege. These are relatively new ideas. Now, obviously, I haven't seen any interviews, recent interviews of him, so I might be totally off the mark. But what do you think to this, Natty? Because obviously he doesn't talk about white guilt or using this as a weapon against white people who are trying to organize. That's one thing that he doesn't broach.
Well, to that, I would say that if the Holocaust didn't have so much power as a phrase and as an idea and as a Jewish religion, de facto Jewish religion, and if this was still the late 60s, early 70s, then Norman Finkelstein with this book may have been an ally to white European politics or self-realization, white nationalism, whatever you want to label it, right? But I think things have gone too far, and that this book with its narrow scope should only be viewed as a text against what Norman Finkelstein calls the Holocaust industry. Now, in my notes, I've got one of my final notes I made earlier this morning when I finished reading the book is only shorthand, but it says this. This is my notes I'm reading from now. Finkelstein doesn't seem to be able to question whether Jews should be in a position of power. He seems to take it for granted. And I've got a couple of other notes there, but throughout the book, he alludes to the fact that Jews and blacks and all these other supposedly aggrieved groups should be allying up. He doesn't say allying up against who, but the implication is clear. The countries that he's talking about are America, so against European whites in America, and probably today in Europe, a kind of league of Arabs and BAME people and Jews against white European interests. I don't think Norman Finkelstein is an ally. And he cements this because a lot of the time in the book, when he talks about this alliance, what he's doing is lamenting, or it seems to me, reading between the lines, he is lamenting that the Holocaust industry is helping to blow these things apart, and that Jews, after using blacks, for instance, in the 1960s, kind of had this acrimonious split with them in terms of the kind of social strata. So I don't think Norman Finkelstein is an ally. I think the book is useful, yes, but he is on a par to me with someone like Jeremy Corbyn.
Okay, same question to Aunt Sally and Bill.
Yeah, I agree with Natty, and it's quite interesting what he said there. I hadn't thought of it that way. For me, at face value, I just assumed that Finkelstein was just an honest, moral person who was outraged by the industry, the Holocaust industry. But yeah, maybe it's more sinister than that, as Natty just said. We also have to consider that he is a boomer, and back then, white privilege wasn't really a thing. Wasn't a thing I grew up with. It was just, it's only been the last 5 years that's all coming out. So yeah, what Natty said, that's given me food for thought. I'll let Bill carry on.
Yeah, I agree as well. And I think the analogy with Jeremy Corbyn's a good one. You know, it's okay to defend an ethnocentric position as long as you're not white. And even then, advocates of ethnocentrism have to negotiate a passage that acknowledges the Holocaust, and if it doesn't, it's sanctioned. And it doesn't apply to us. Go on, sorry.
No, sorry, I'm interrupting, and this is completely off course. So if you had anything else to say, carry on. But
I'll ramble on for hours. You carry on.
No, it's just that there is something in the book that did give me suspicion of Finkelstein as whether or not, you know, is he really, well, he's not our guy, but kind of our guy. And that was the books that he doesn't mention. And I don't know if you intended on covering that tonight, Mark, but he doesn't mention Schindler.
No, please. Look, this is one of those things where, we've got 40 minutes left. We've got a couple of super chats. There aren't many in, and they're not going to take very long to read. So what I was going to say is, if you do have things to raise, guys, and you've got notes, please bring them up, because that's the beauty of book club. There's four different minds here, so go for it.
Yeah, it's the books he didn't talk about. I don't know if you noticed that, Natty and Bill and you, Mark, that he doesn't mention the big ones. He talks about these other little books that I've never heard of that are a fraud. He calls them fraud. They were big books in the Jewish community at the time.
Hold on a sec now, because I just want to jump in. The Night Trilogy by Elie Wiesel, Elie Wiesel.
I want to talk about Elie Wiesel as well.
Yeah. It's one of the foundational texts that they give to kids in America. So I don't blame you for not ever hearing about it, but I think it's one of the books that really is drummed into kids at a young age in the United States of how bad the Holocaust is, and this kind of this neurotic, weird violence porn that Elie Wiesel conjures up in that book. But sorry, carry on.
No, I mean, for me, the three books that jump out at me is Schindler's List and Frank's Diary. Doesn't mention that, or Schindler's List or Sophie's Choice. I don't know if that was a book. I'm presuming it was. I just know it was a film. He doesn't mention them. Why not? Because they are particularly Schindler's List. I mean, I think that's kids in England, that kids have to watch that at school, don't they? So he doesn't mention that, and that makes me think, hang on.
Can I ask something, Sally? Just to cut in, because I understand what you're saying, but you're a little bit older than me, and I don't mean that as an insult, but has there been a shift in the books people have read? And I'm not defending him or saying that, he hasn't done what you're saying, but is it different in America, and has the focus on which books children read about the Holocaust changed over the years? So what I'm saying is, when he wrote this, was he actually making a good point, which later becomes less of a good point as time goes by?
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that. But then, okay, Schindler's List, that was made... I can't remember, you reviewed it on Film Club, didn't you? Schindler's List was... I think around the 2000s, that's what I remember. But Anne Frank's Diary was always there. He doesn't mention that. He doesn't mention the controversy around it either.
And
why?
Do you remember, Sally? I'm older than you as well, Mark, of course. And one of the things I can remember unfolding, because we were never taught about, we never learnt about the Holocaust at school in the 70s in history. It wasn't touched upon. Or at least it was touched upon in a very parsimonious way. But I remember it unfolding, and I can remember it starting to unfold. With the benefit of hindsight, looking back at that time, there were programs like, I think it was called The Winds of War with Robert Mitchum in. So Hollywood was really starting to grind up the ante in the late 70s and the early 80s, and it started to happen on... Did you remember those, Sally? Do you remember those ones? I remember that sort of starting, that sort of dramatising the Holocaust in a way which had never been seen before. So it really did start to come into play.
Even in the 60s, it used to be a family thing that on a Sunday afternoon we'd have Sunday dinner, and then we'd watch whatever film was on. It'd either be a Western or it'd be a war film, and that was in the 60s. And... the war films, even then, as a child watching them, they were quite shocking. I remember the one film about the lampshades, and they tied this woman's legs together. She was about to have a baby, this poor Jew. They tied her legs together. I remember being traumatised and saying to my dad, what happened to her? What did they do? And, you know, but what you said about what we learned at school, no, we didn't learn anything about the war, why it happened. And you didn't ask. I didn't ask, and I didn't even ask my father, because I was frightened. I'd get, you don't know why your family, why I went to war. And the same at school. I thought my teachers would say, you don't know why our country went to war. So you didn't ask. You just didn't ask. And that's why even being in this book club, I'm learning more than I ever learned about what, particularly with Hellstorm. That was an eye-opener for me. Even this book is eye-opening. But yeah, Bill, the anti, I think that it was non-stop war stuff. And the world at war, that was the 70s, wasn't it?
It was, yes. Yeah.
I remember the theme tune to that. It's sort of in my brain. It was just all those bodies just being shoveled from here to there. And it really did affect your psyche.
So, it does correlate. It correlates exactly what Finkelstein's saying about the shift in the kind of power play as well.
One of the things you've got to remember, guys, is that these decisions, or the inclusion of Holocaust education right into the psyche of young European children, none of us, and I think I'm including Sal in this, none of us are old enough to remember a time when that wasn't the case in some form or other. Like you say, the world at war is from the 70s. I've seen the world at war. I know the theme tune you're talking about, and I enjoy it. But even there wasn't a time where some form of triumphalism over the victory in the Second World War, we beat the Nazis and that's what we're great at, and that's our kind of national religion now. Forget about Christianity and all the rest of it. The real important thing is we beat the Nazis and it was a moral victory. And, you know, the Holocaust stuff gets let in slowly, and then, you know, in secondary school you learn about it and all the rest of it. I don't think any of us, and I'm pretty sure I'm including you again, Sal, in this, remembers a time before the 70s, before the kind of 60s, 70s, where that was the case. So this has always been a thing in some way or another, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I was born, say, 1960. So, you know, I'm talking about 65, 66, 67, these films. And I just remember I went to a church school, and sometimes the Jews would move into the area. Until there was a space in the Jewish school, they'd come to our school. And I remember if this Jewish girl came to our school, they'd only be there a couple of weeks. And you felt so, so sorry for them because Holocaust. And I can remember, like, you know, everyone going and patting her on the back and looking at her with sad eyes. Oh, were your parents Holocaust, from the Holocaust? And you couldn't, it was just, you just literally pitied them. Like, oh, you poor Jewish person, you suffered. You know, you couldn't even, you sort of have a conversation with them. You'd be frightened in case you upset them. And then when you met a German, it'd be, there's a kraut. You know, you had this hatred of Germans, like they did this, and, you know, from that all came from the films. Those films, I'm going to cough. Sorry, those films that we saw on a Sunday afternoon did a lot of damage for me.
Anyway. I would agree with that, and I think that certainly the kinds of Hollywood outpourings in that 30-year period exacerbated that. Going back to Finkelstein, yeah, he doesn't. He does avoid certain questions, but can I just, Mark? Are you happy for me to talk a bit about Elie Wiesel?
Yeah, sure, go for it. Take the floor, my friend.
This was, on a personal note, this was my favourite part of the book, and there's lots of parts of the book which I originally found when I first read it very eye-opening, but this. Just rereading it, this was a kind of a positive vindication for me, because for those of you who don't know who Elie Wiesel was, or he was somebody who made an enormous amount of money about his victimhood. And in his own memoirs, he talks about the fire hypothesis. So after the end of the war, there were various hypotheses about how the extermination had proceeded. And some of them were things like boiling water, gassing, electrocution, and fire, killing people in various different ways. And he published a text in 1956. He published it in Yiddish. And in those, when he published it, the notion that Jews were exterminated by fire was still relatively current. And that's the origin of the term, of course, or the origin of the use of the term Holocaust. No mainstream historians believe that Jews were burned alive. Now that notion has been just debunked. And the myths of, similarly, the myths of deaths by boiling water and electrocution have also disappeared. And the gassing theory was taken up by American scholars. I'm not going to, you know, go into all the revisionist arguments about it, but it's interesting. He talks in his memoir Night, that Wiesel reports that in Auschwitz there was a flaming ditch for adults and another ditch for babies. I'm going to quote from him. He says, "Not far from us, flames were leaping up from a ditch, gigantic flames. They were burning something. A lorry drew up at the pit and delivered its load. Little children, babies, yes, I saw it. Saw it with my own eyes. Those children in the flames, it is surprising that I could not sleep after that. Sleep has fled from my eyes." And this is all nonsense. And it's not from a revisionist point of view. This is verifiably orthodox. Historians regard this as all nonsense. But this is a man who was fated for years and years and paid he charged enormous sums of money to travel around and talk about his experiences. And this is one of the things, I think, which is, it's quite illuminating that Finkelstein touches upon this and debunks him. He talks about it being a kind of a mystical religion of the event of the Holocaust. That, you know, Wiesel would say that, you know, it defies knowledge and description. It cannot be explained or visualized. And then he would charge a standard fee of $25,000 plus a chauffeured limousine to lecture on the secret of Auschwitz and truth and lies and silence. I thought that was really illuminating. And I think that's one of the, because Wiesel is a huckster, absolutely, and is a proven huckster, I think. And that was one of the things that I really enjoyed about this book, was his kind of takedown of Wiesel. Go on, Natty.
I was really hoping you didn't bring up the quote at the end of the page on 82, because, like you say, Finkelstein's ripping into Elie Wiesel, and he's talking about how what a blatant fraud and what a blatant liar he is. And he says, and to the New York Times reporter, Wiesel recalls that he was once hit by a taxi in Times Square. He says, "I flew an entire block. I was hit on 45th Street and Broadway, and the ambulance picked me up on 44th. The truth as I presented is unvarnished," Wiesel sighs. "I cannot do otherwise." So he's saying he got hit by a taxi in New York and managed to fly 300 feet into another dimension, presumably, and then ended up, you know, in a different block somewhere else. So this guy, he's very used to dealing in lies. And I haven't read Night. I wish I'd had time to read Night in preparation for this, because I've read a lot on various Telegram meme pages where people have taken pages out of certain books and ridiculed them, masturbation machines and steam machines and bears and eagles and the like. But I wish I'd had time to read Elie Wiesel's Night, because I think that would be a source of much hilarity.
Well, I think that's where Finkelstein is useful in this context, where he does. And again, coming back to what we said right at the beginning, there's a kind of an autistic element to him where he does, if he sees an untruth, he states this. Now, we know that he's not Argy, as we say, and he's not touching upon various other topics and aspects. But when he does deal with these things, he does it. He does try and deal with it in a kind of rigorously analytical way, and he takes Wiesel apart. It's good to read. And others who, I mean, people who he talks about who were, well, there was that Swiss guy who claimed he was Jewish and had all these terrible things done to him. And then he wasn't even Jewish. He was just on the bandwagon. But then because his text was regarded as being canon, his protectors or his advocates would say that, it's the spirit of it is true. So he's good at exploding those kind of bizarre aspects of what, as Finkelstein terms, a mystery religion.
Yeah, well, I think Kolominsky maybe, or Kolminsky or something.
That's the one.
Basically, Elie Wiesel is the kind of top of the pyramid of these scamming fraudster Jews. And then you've got all these other aspiring liars underneath him who are copying him. He gives quite a good example where I think in Elie Wiesel's Night, he talks about, the eyes couldn't see and the soul is going through the eyes and all this great big paragraph about his eyes. And this other guy just rips him off completely and does the same thing. But they're such a closed group that they all praise each other. They know they're all fraudsters and they're ripping each other off and claiming money that they don't deserve. But they're all like, oh, yeah, he's a great guy. Yeah, he's great. His writing's so amazing. You know, so it's just like, right. You pull back the tarpaulin and you just see all these rats scurrying around. Ah! I think that's one of the joys of the early part of this book is Norman Finkelstein's disdain for these people.
It's where it comes back to the book's flawed for me in some ways, but its significance is the fact that perhaps, you know, as a Jewish writer, he's able to say these things, even though he's regarded as a self-hating Jew by his critics. He gets away with it because of his position, but although he suffered for it in some degree, but he explodes the myth, and he illustrates that not only is this huge kind of machine grifting and getting enormous sums of money, but it builds this kind of mystery religion.
Yeah, sorry, I just want to correct myself. It's Will Komersky was the fraud who ripped off Elie Wiesel. But to the point you're making, yeah, I mean, this book is available on Amazon, I think, or last time I checked it was.
That's where I purchased your copies.
Exactly. I mean, what other publication, again, just speaking to this ever so slightly, is that Norman Finkelstein is Jewish, so that maybe he's given some leeway to speak about these things and the fact he's a kind of progressive type, Jeremy Corbyn kind of type. Anyone else who had a book that contained the kind of criticisms and debunking of Elie Wiesel et al, you wouldn't be able to find it on Amazon. So you're right, I think there's some aspect of ethnic shielding going on there.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, but I am going to throw this out as well. I do think this book is one of those books that's been around for a long time, and I do think when you look at Amazon and you look at some of the stuff that Amazon allows on there, things that have been there for quite a long time seem to, and have a lot of reviews, etc., seem to stay around longer than new things that are added recently. And that's not to make an excuse for this, but it certainly is a trend. But I do think his Jewishness obviously does give him a certain degree of sort of fireproofing towards, you know, stuff that would come at, say, a goy. And this is quite interesting as well. In the interview, and I've posted it in the live chat, the one that I watched, he does refer to whites as goys. He does refer to them as goys. And I found that really interesting, not least because you tend to find that Jews are very, very hesitant to use that term around whites or around Gentiles. They don't like to use the term goy. But again, he does. And to me, he does seem, whether he's aligned with us or not, I'd have to say he does seem very, very honest, very, very willing to discuss a range of topics. But also, he does seem sort of warts and all. And even though he doesn't seem to be coming at things from our point of view, and in some ways is potentially hostile to, you know, white well-being or, you know, people of European descent flourishing and taking their, you know, destiny back into their own hands, he does seem so dispassionate about things and so focused on the truth that ultimately I think he's been quite a help to us. Would you all agree with that? I mean, I've got to say, I still really enjoyed the book. And I still think it's quite, obviously you'll be able to sum this up at the end, but I still think he's a greater, he presents more positives to our movement than he does negatives.
Yeah, I have been reading between the lines a lot, and I have focused on the kind of white well-being, white nationalism aspect of what this book means. But you're right, he is honest and he's got his own motivations, and there's nothing wrong with that. And the book is illuminating and it is useful, and he is calling out one of the greatest scams of our time, although it's not calling out some of the machinations or the kind of the engine beneath the hood of it. He's calling out one of the most visible and repulsive aspects of it that people who aren't like us would understand. And that's the money grubbing, not only from countries who, you know, really don't have anything to apologize for, but in his own terms, he makes it absolutely clear that the money that they're grifting is actually taking away money from who he believes actually deserves the money. That's why he calls it a double shakedown. It's not just a shakedown of the Swiss and the Poles and the Germans. It's a shakedown of actual, what he sees as actual victims and actual deserving survivors of the Holocaust. And again, it's on Amazon, and I do actually recommend this book, although I would have been interested to speak to Norman Finkelstein.
Whoa, don't jump ahead, my friend. We've got to do the super chats before ruin it. Right, let's do some super chats. We've only got a few tonight, but we'll blast through these. They're mainly statements. WPWW, I think that stands for White Power Worldwide, he gave 1488. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, Rule Britannia, God save England. Well, thank you very much, my friend. Black Pigeon Pilled gave one Odyssey token. And he says, going around the panel, do you consider Finkelstein to be our guy? I think we already answered that one, so thank you very much for that, Penny. Thin Red Line gave $14.88. Thank you so much. He said, great stream. I think I want to buy a copy of The Holocaust Industry. Well, yes, it is very cheap. And I also saw it somewhere. I don't know exactly where, because I had a look today. And if you buy the, audiobook, I saw it for £2.84 on audiobook. So that's just a steal. And obviously you get it read to you, so it's a lot easier going. So yeah, I do recommend picking it up. No, I've violated my own rule. I've just given you my final thoughts. Damn it. Milos M gave $3. Thank you so much. He said, great thought-provoking stream. I have a thought-provoking question for you, Mark. Would you invite for a debate a person of Jewish descent who is red-pilled on identitarian issues and JQ like Bobby Fischer was? Yeah, of course I would. I mean, I've spoken to Jews before. I famously debated four of them at the same time. And that was quite fun. But I've never actually spoken to one never actually had one on the show who agrees with our ideas or, you know, wants to talk about things from our perspective. But, you know, this is obviously, I'm sure plenty of people listen to this show and we've got really good numbers tonight. So ultimately, yes, if there happens to be any Jews listening to this who do agree with the sort of stuff that we talk about, then I would be more than happy to have you on the show or to, you know, to work with you in some way to produce, you know, an interesting piece of content that discusses things in a way that isn't antagonistic between Jews and Gentiles. I think that would be a really interesting stream. But generally, I have never actually met, and this isn't to say they don't exist, but it could be quite telling, really, that I've never actually met anyone of Jewish descent who has decided to ally with white nationalists. So, yeah. But if there is someone out there and you are listening to this show and you want to email me and you can vouch for yourself so it's not just some big troll, I would happily have you on a show and talk about things and try to form some common ground. Because if people have missed it, I did the Domino Effect podcast a few weeks back, which was me talking to some black guys and trying to find some common ground. So I would do that with any racial group, definitely. So that is something for everyone to think
about. I'm of the opinion, Mark, that the Jew who's on board with white European nationalism simply does not exist. You can get red versus blue, you can get counter Islam, counter jihad, you can get left wing progressive, you can get right wing business, you can get right wing pro J Zionism type of Jews, but I think this is the one area where maybe even Bobby Fischer, although maybe not Bobby Fischer, is simply not willing to go. But those are just my two pennies.
Can I just interrupt? Because I'm sure, Horace speak to one. Gilad Atzmon, that name rings a bell. But I'm sure he was speaking to one a couple of years ago. He did a few shows with him.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, Gilad Atzmon. Yeah. Horace has spoken to him a few times. He's a reasonable guy, I think. He might come on.
Well, look, if anyone can get me in touch with him, write to him. Put me in touch with him. Obviously, I would be more than willing to have him on a show and to, you know, discuss openly and honestly these sort of issues. You know, we definitely make for an interesting show. And I want to find common ground with everyone. I mean, I debated that guy called the Muslim Skeptic. We ended up agreeing on quite a few things. I went down to the Domino Effect podcast. People will have seen that I have, you know, made inroads with different groups, and I used to do that before as well when I was part of the BNP. So absolutely, yeah, that is something I would do. Open Borders for Israel said, so many books to choose from, but is anyone familiar with Lothrop Stoddard? He was a white nationalist intellectual in the early to mid 20th century. His book The Rising Tide of Color is prophetic. I haven't actually heard of that. Open Borders for Israel also gave another $3. Sorry, Bill, what did you say?
I was just going to say I've got a copy of that. It's a good book.
Is it? Oh, okay, well, we could definitely consider that one for the future. And Normal Finkelstein's career was destroyed by Alan Dershowitz, who also defended the free speech pornography cases, such as Deep Throat. Yeah, Alan Dershowitz is absolutely vile. I didn't know his career was destroyed. I didn't know he destroyed Norman Finkelstein's career, though. And if so, how did he do that? Do any of you have any information on that?
I don't know. All I know is when I tried to contact Norman Finkelstein, his Twitter account, if it was his Twitter account, wasn't getting much engagement. So there may be some validity to the fact that his career was destroyed.
Yeah, I can imagine there was a lot of daggers out for him, just as there have been for others. I mean, one of the most interesting things is there seems to be sort of quite a high incidence of very high IQ, often chess masters and other people who start to discuss the Holocaust because, you know, these guys can see 11 moves ahead and can obviously see when something doesn't add up. But they often are then completely ruined. So anyone that does speak about, well, I mean, look at me. I mean, how many bank accounts have I lost now? You know, I'm not even allowed a bank account here in the UK for advocating for our people. So I'm sure somebody who writes a book like The Holocaust Industry has probably faced a number of different restrictions on their life. That would sort of stand to reason. Finally, NC Pigeon said, hi, would you consider reviewing Kevin MacDonald's recent book, Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition? Yes, I would. Would people like that book for next month? What do you guys think? Would you, if I reached out to Kevin tomorrow, would you guys be interested in reviewing another Kevin MacDonald book?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I would like as well, since we're doing requests, is any, I think Antelope Hill, I think some collaboration between ourselves and Antelope Hill would be good at any point. But yeah, Kevin MacDonald, absolutely fantastic guest, definitely.
Okay, well, I'll ask Kevin if he's free. And if he is, I will wing over a couple of his books to all of you guys. And yeah, we can go from there. I mean, I think that'd be brilliant to do. And I am a massive, massive fan of Kevin MacDonald. I'm just actually having a look at how many pages it is, though, because I know that.
I do worry.
601 pages. I mean, that is.
You better get the copies out early then. Maybe you can have the abridged version.
If we're doing requests, a good person to get on who can talk well about it is Dave Martell, and the Bizarrechives. And I'm saying that.
Yeah, we've done his before.
Yeah, I've got vested interest because I'm published by them, but they're producing great books all the time.
Yeah, I would love to do that as well. Well, we might wait, because obviously if I get the books out to you with this being a late month, it would only give us a very limited, you know, we'd only give you 3 weeks to read that, because we'd be doing the next one on the 28th. So we might look for a shorter book, but I will sort something out. But yeah, I definitely want to work with Kevin MacDonald again. But I try to keep books under 300 pages for obvious reasons, not least because I have to read them. That's a lot of reading. But I do love Kevin MacDonald. He's an absolutely amazing man. And it would be amazing to have him on again, because he came on before. And that was a very, very good episode. So, look, we're coming towards the end. Let's go around the group. Everyone give your final impressions. And do you recommend the book? We will start with you, Natty. Take it away, my friend.
Yes, I do recommend the book, although with a couple of caveats in that. As I alluded to before, the scope is slightly narrower than I would have liked, and that's a personal preference. I realize that I'm quite jaded, and I kind of expect certain things to go along with other things. If I've got bread, I want jam and butter with it as well, not just the bread, if that analogy holds up. But it is a good book, and as everyone said, Norman Finkelstein does seem to be an honest purveyor of his thoughts and of his political ideas. So I would recommend the book, and it is very informative, thought-provoking, and will make you angry and probably laugh in at some various point throughout the books. I will say there are two appendices to the book in which he responds to these findings. They're in the edition that I've got, which is the second edition. They may not be in the other editions, but they do add about 100 pages onto the back end of it. But there's good stuff in there as well, and it's all very well sourced. So if you're a big brain, or if you're an autist and you like numbers and you like responses and you like references, definitely go for this one.
Okay, Sally, what are your final thoughts, my dear?
Yeah, I highly recommend the book. Even though the actual nuts and bolts of it, 150 pages, it's packed with information. It really is. There's a lot to think about. It took me longer to read than I thought, even because of there's so much information. So I highly recommend it. I really, really liked it. And it's funny, I had a boomer friend round, and they know what I'm about. And what are you reading now? And picked up the book. Oh, is it against another thing against Jews? I'm like, no, it's written by a Jew. They're like, what? So it was refreshing to have something from the other side, you know. And so, yeah, I highly recommend it. I'll move on.
No, if you've got more to say, Sally, go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's worth reading, and it's not too much. It's cheap enough, and you can get it for free if you look in the right places. So definitely worth reading a copy. Right.
Thank you. Bill, what are your final thoughts? And I'll wrap up with mine.
I first read this book, as I said earlier, about 15 or 20 years ago, and it played a really large part in my awakening, if you want to term it that way. I think it's a great book to recommend, especially if somebody who's starting to have questions. I mean, it is important to remember that he writes from what is ostensibly a leftist position. Concern, I think, as Nassim mentioned, he compares the positing of the Jews as unique when compared to the neglect afforded to the legal restitution afforded to African Americans or gays, for example. But despite that caveat, it does offer valuable insights into the political shenanigans of Zionist power, especially in the United States. And it falls into that time-worn category, my enemy's enemy is my friend, I think. and like the Holocaust revisionist David Cole, Finkelstein is to some degree a Jewish dissident. He's certainly a dissident in the eyes of his detractors and the Zionist establishment. Unlike David Cole, he is protesting from a different wing of the political spectrum. But it's a book that's filled with interesting takes, statistics, and really a useful tool to arm yourself for debating. It really underlines the comment by the Jewish writer Leon Jick, who wrote that devastating barb, "There is no business like show a business." And that, sad to say, is a recognisable truth.
Well, thank you, Bill. Now, my thoughts are this. I liked this book. I liked it a lot. And I liked it a lot because it was short, it was to the point, it was packed with information, and it proved its point very quickly, very concisely. It's basically like a bit like a literary version of a scalpel. It's small but very pointed, does what it needs to do very efficiently, and gets straight to the point of the matter. And it was only about £7.34, which also helps a lot. Now, you can get it for free online, but I do recommend getting an actual physical copy. I also think this book is important because it's important to back things up with facts, and this book is full of it. But it's also important because I think the fact that it's written by a Jew, and the Jew's motivation, Norman Finkelstein's motivation for writing this, is very different to our motivations when we talk about these things. Often we talk about the power of the Holocaust for political reasons. But Norman Finkelstein, being a Jew, is talking about this for emotional reasons, because he actually has an attachment to his parents and their experiences. And I think in many ways that makes this book more important than other books on this same topic that were written by Gentiles. Because I think you could give this to someone who was potentially skeptical of our message because they know our politics, but they could take this book, take it on board, read it, and come to a series of eye-opening, wonderful conclusions that actually helps them to develop their politics and maybe see us in a different light. And that's why I do think this is really important. I think it should have a place on everybody's bookshelf, really. And I think his work's wonderful. I should have really reached out to him myself beforehand, but I wasn't even aware if he was still alive or whether he would come on. It's one of those sort of legendary books that you wouldn't really expect an author like him would want to spend his Sunday evening with us, you know, on Odyssey and DLive. But maybe that was a mistake of mine. I think he definitely deserves a few sales. He deserves our thanks. And whether he agrees with us on every issue, I think he's an interesting bedfellow. And he admitted that himself in that interview that I shared. In that interview that I watched, he was actually asked what he thought to, you know, the quote-unquote right wing endorsing him. And he wasn't fazed by that. He wasn't bothered. He never attacked us. He never sort of slagged us off. He just said that he was interested in the truth. And if other people wished to share that truth, he didn't mind as long as they were sharing the truth. And again, that's very, very honest. So, yeah, I endorse this. I think it's worth reading. And it's one of those books that's in my range of reading it in a short period of time. So as I'm a more casual book reader and not the biggest bookworm in the world, I give it extra points for that as well. So we do have one last super chat. It's from Stan One, who gave 108 Odyssey tokens. Thank you so much. It's a great stream, really informative. Thanks to all for your time going through the book and this subject in detail. Well, I think it's been a really productive night. I've really enjoyed it, and we've all really enjoyed the book. So if you're looking for something to read over the remainder of the bank holiday, I would definitely suggest reading this book is better than watching all that coronation rubbish that's being shoved down our throats at the moment. If you're at a loose end tomorrow, you can always get the PDF version. And I don't know, maybe Amazon could even get you a copy for some time tomorrow if you're living in one of those areas where Prime delivers within 12 hours. Anyway, that brings us to a close. Would everyone like to say their goodbyes, and then I'll wrap things up?
Night-night, everyone. See you next time for whichever book we decide to eviscerate. Thank you.
Good night, everyone. It's been a great stream. I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed the book as well. So Thank you.
Yeah, evening, folks, and thanks for having me on again, Mark. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you to everyone. Thank you to Natty and Sally and Bill. It's been a really wonderful night. Thank you so much to everyone who donated so generously from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for that. These generous donations are what keeps me doing the job I do. And I love you all very much for helping me do that. And of course, my biggest thanks goes to those in the community who support these streams by watching them, liking them and sharing them. I think it's been a really, really good night tonight. We've had really, really strong numbers. And remember, after the stream's finished, there will be uploads of it on Odyssey and BitChute, so you can share it. That just leaves me to say thank you all. I hope you have a wonderful long weekend, a great bank holiday Monday, and I will see you next week on Wednesday for Patriotic Weekly Review, and the special guest is Adam Green, so I'm sure that will be a very informative and fiery show. Thank you all, have a great weekend, see you again soon.